Have you heard of the term translanguaging? In this episode, we're going to explore this emerging concept in language teaching with Dr. Uju Anya, an associate professor of second language acquisition at Carnegie Mellon University. She helps us to understand exactly what translanguaging is and how beneficial it can be in the process of acquiring language. So let's jump in. Are you a language teacher looking for some reassurance that what you're doing in the classroom is on the right track? Or maybe you're looking for some ways to teach even more effectively? If you're one or the other or somewhere in between, you've landed in the right place. This is the World Language Classroom Podcast with your host, me, Joshua Cabral. You're about to get tips, tools, and resources so that your students continue to rise in proficiency and communicate with confidence. Let's jump in. Vamos, allons-y. Hello, my friends. Bonjour, mes amis. Hola, mis amigos. Welcome to the World Language Classroom Podcast. I am Joshua Cabral, and you know, particularly if you're listening to this in the car on the way to school, that I want to remind you, you're an incredible language teacher because you're listening to a podcast about language teaching. So thank you for listening, but thank you for being that teacher going the extra mile to just look at your practice. So today, we're going to be using this word translanguaging. And if you've been at language conferences lately, if you're seeing things on social media, this is a term in language learning, language teaching that is emerging. A lot of us are talking about it. I have personally had a lot of questions about what it is to truly understand it. So to do that, I have invited the wonderful Dr. Uju Anya onto the podcast so that we can explore this topic of translanguaging. Dr. Uju Anya is an associate professor of second language acquisition at Carnegie Mellon University, and she is in the Department of Languages, Cultures, and Applied Linguistics, formerly the Department of Modern Languages. And she has a number of publications, including Racialized Identities in Second Language Learning, Speaking Blackness in Brazil, Racial Equality on College Campuses, Connecting Research and Practice, and a number of articles that explore the many facets of language within a political realm of language teaching. And one that particularly she wants to highlight for us today is Critical Race Pedagogy for More Effective and Inclusive World Language Teaching, where she really gets into this idea of anti-racism and equity with language learning and language teaching. So she has so much to share. So she was the one I wanted to bring on to have this conversation. And I personally studied applied linguistics in my graduate work as well. And when I first went into it, I had this idea that it was all about how to learn and teach a second language, because that's how it was built. But once I got into the program, I realized that there's this whole realm of sociolinguistics, which is really looking at how language is used to wield power in many situations. And there are so many components connected to language, from race and identity, sexuality, and all of these different things that come into it. And so I became fascinated with applied linguistics that way. And I saw it as so much more than just language learning and language teaching. And so I very much appreciate that Dr. Uju Anya is very much entrenched in that world of applied linguistics. So Dr. Uju Anya, I could talk about you forever because I think you're fascinating. So why don't you just come in the conversation? Thank you so much for being here on the podcast.
Thank you so much for inviting me. And I'm excited to be here. I'm always happy to talk to language teachers. I myself am a language teacher. I was for a very long time, even in the K-12 realm. I taught high school Spanish. I also was a lecturer at post-secondary institutions in Portuguese and in Spanish. And so even before I went into the PhD for applied linguistics, I was in the trenches of the foreign language classroom and the world language classroom. So I'm very excited to be here and to talk to my people.
Could you give us some of your own personal insights that when you use this terminology of anti-racism, particularly when it comes to language learning and language teaching. And so I'm referencing your article on critical race pedagogy. Can you talk to us about that framework and understanding?
So there is this notion that's very popular in our field that because we teach world languages and because we are predisposed to learning about other people, other cultures, other languages, that our field shouldn't be concerned with issues of conflict or racism or xenophobia or inter-ethnic anything, right? Because, well, we're nice. We're the people that seek out other people. And we, you know, we so much so that we learn their languages and cultures. So we don't have those problems. That's the assumption. And that's actually an ideology in our field. And then there's also this other ideology in our field that the isms of the world don't enter into our classroom somehow. The racism, the sexism, the homophobia, classism, elitism, all those things are just somehow outside of our classrooms. And then when we come into the world language classroom, we all of a sudden become this imagined and perfect utopia of everybody loving everybody and learning everybody's languages. And that's just not true. We do not stop being who we are when we walk into a world language classroom, nor do we stop having all the problems that we have and the social hierarchies, inequities, etc. That we have outside the classroom. They don't end because we walk into the classroom, mm-hmm. or they don't end outside of our textbooks and learning materials. Mm-hmm. So racism is definitely a concern for us in world languages. It's a concern in how we relate with students. And it's also a huge concern in the materials that we use for language instruction. Mm-hmm. We have to deal with anti-blackness, for example, in those materials, erasure of entire populations that are part of the target language speaking world that we just don't see represented equitably or even in positive ways in our materials. And there's also a lot of exclusion and elitism with regard to the images that we show, houses, for example, that we show, or living situations that we teach when we teach house vocabulary and things like that tend to be middle upper class. In the Western languages we teach, it tends to be very European dominated populations and cultures and images. Spanish, for example, over more than 33% of Spanish speakers worldwide are Black. And you don't even see that in our materials, and you wouldn't even know that Black people speak Spanish if you were to just rely on how we present Spanish speakers in our classes. Mm-hmm. For example, that's just one example. Mm-hmm. So anti-racism is definitely a concern for us, and it's a value that I hope that we learn more about and we promote in the work that we do in world language classrooms.
Mm-hmm. You know, often when I work with teachers or school districts, and looking how departments are going about their work, there's this understanding or this assumption that these are topics that are for upper levels. Yes. You know, that this doesn't happen at the lower levels. And the simple fact of asking a 7-year-old who's studying Spanish, what's your favorite color? The answer to that question could have huge political ramifications when it comes to sexism and homophobia by yes. simply asking that question. So we think it's this higher order thing. No, it can actually be at that level.
It can actually be at that level, especially if the 7-year-old says, well, I don't like pink because pink is a girl's yeah. color, you know? Mm-hmm. So what are we going yeah. to, how are we going to yeah. unpack, mm-hmm. You know, the patriarchal values yeah. embedded in this notion that, you know, we can assign colors to gender and we can, you know, deprecate certain tastes or colors or things mm-hmm. that are viewed as very feminine. Mm-hmm. And also sexuality, right? Human sexuality and sexual diversity is something that's also considered a higher level or even considered something that's too controversial mm-hmm. to be in language classes. Mm-hmm. And number one, that's a huge lie. Because we talk about about sexuality every day in language classes from day one. Mm-hmm. The difference is whose sexuality you're talking about. Mm-hmm. We talk about heterosexuality and we talk about heteronormativity all the time. Look at the family chapter, the family unit, mm-hmm. when we start teaching vocabularies. What are the pictures that we show when we teach about weddings, for example, mm-hmm. and couplings and courtship vocabulary and rituals? How do you ask somebody out on a date? Mm-hmm. Or even, you know, who is a typical family in this culture that we're learning about? It's usually mom, dad, and children. And this is a heterosexual presenting mm-hmm. unit. This is a heteronormative frame that from day one we are imposing on our classrooms. Mm-hmm. And this is a conversation about sexuality. Mm-hmm. But since, you know, the dominant sexuality is looked upon as so normalized mm-hmm. and invisible, we don't even think that we're talking right. about sexuality. And we don't even think that we're talking about gender and things mm-hmm. like that, because we're talking about dominant and normative values and ideologies. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we are. What we're doing is actually erasing and actively purposefully leaving out LGBTQ plus populations from our language classes because somehow we deem it too controversial and we say sexuality doesn't belong. Mm-hmm. We believe it belongs and we talk about it all the time. Whose right. sexuality is the difference?
Right. And it's just looking at this idea that sometimes we look at, oh, we have to do a unit or directly talk about anti-racism. And yes, there's a place for that. And we should definitely bring that into our classrooms. But a lot of it is just the windows and mirrors, you know, those yeah. things to at those different levels. So I could talk to you about this forever because this is a fascinating topic that we all need to talk about. But I have so many questions about trans languaging.
No problem.
And I don't think they're completely disconnected.
Not at all.
Maybe some of the things Jimmy's saying. But can you just start by unpacking a little bit what this term translanguaging is?
Sure. Translanguaging is this notion that we are not monolingual. Usually when we talk about translanguaging, it's more helpful to tell you kind of what it's not, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of people will say, well, isn't that just another way of saying code switching, right? And code switching is this notion that languages are these separate unitary like systems, right? And you switch between them. So one day you're doing this and another, you know, day you're doing that, or one minute you go from one to another. So translanguaging is sort of coming from the perspective of the languager, right? The person who is languaging. And saying that from our perspective, right, as languagers, there is no separation between languages, right? We just know what we know about languaging in general. And we do language, or we language, well, based upon our needs at the time, based upon what is clear for us, based upon what is easiest for us to be able to say, based upon what it makes sense at the time. So let's say English, Spanish, Italian, whatever it is that you have understandings of, all of that is working in your mind. And all of that contributes to however you language, what you write, what you say, how you present, all of that information and knowledge you have is contributing to what you ultimately produce. So translanguaging is this notion that it's all there and it's all part of it. Now, from the outside, you may be able to recognize, okay, you're doing English right now. I'm recognizing English words. I'm recognizing grammar in English, etc. Or if you were to be able to be producing Spanish, I'm recognizing it from the outside. So that separateness is out there. But translanguaging comes from the inside and says that, no, all of it is together. And what we see as separate is from the outside, right? And this is important. This notion of translanguaging, because if we understand that we're all languaging in a very kind of unique and mixed way, for lack of a better way to put it, then that means that you don't have to have this artificial immersion situation, right? Where there's only one monolingual code. Like, you don't have to enforce that, right? If people are going to language, however they're going to language, and they're going to use whatever skills they know to be able to produce whatever it is that they need at the time, then it's okay for them to do that in order to reach the goals of learning or speaking and however it turns out. Mm-hmm. That's what translanguaging is all about. Mm-hmm. This notion that everything that we know about language and all the known languages that we, you know, are familiar with all get together and contribute to what it is that we're doing when we're languaging. Mm-hmm. The separation, the enforcement of you only have to be in the target language and everything you have, you say, write has to be uncontaminated, untouched somehow by other languages. That is an artificial notion. Mm-hmm. And that is a notion that actually harms more than helps. Mm-hmm. That is what translanguaging is all about. Mm-hmm. And translanguaging is also something that is a lot more prevalent in the work that we do in bilingual education and classes where it's sort of understood that people are going to come and they're going to be doing multiple languages. So we talk mm-hmm. more about translanguaging there. But I believe the translanguaging belongs in world languages, especially so we can break down this expectation that we have to operate monolingually mm-hmm. and we have to teach people to speak new languages as if they were monolinguals mm-hmm. in that new language and they don't have any other kind of knowledge about any other kind of language.
Right. So this idea that languages are housed separately within our mind brain. And
yes.
So that's it's so artificial when you put it that way. It's like, oh, well, of course Spanish doesn't live in this section of my brain. And I only tap into that when I need it.
Exactly. And I also have to tell you, we have an ideology of who is a bilingual, right? That portrays a bilingual as if they were two monolinguals inside one body, mm-hmm. right? When we consider somebody like a perfect bilingual, mm-hmm. we consider that person a speaker of like a bilingual in English and Spanish. Mm-hmm. We consider that person a speaker of English who sounds like they don't know any other language in mm-hmm. English. So they speak English like a monolingual English speaker, and they speak Spanish like a monolingual Spanish speaker. Mm-hmm. They speak it like they don't know any other language. Mm-hmm. So once you arrive at that supposed, you know, mm-hmm. glorified condition that nobody, by the way, can ever achieve, it's not real, then you're considered, oh, you're a real bilingual because you can do these languages mm-hmm. perfectly and independently of each mm-hmm. other, mm-hmm. which, number one, does not exist in the human brain, and it doesn't even exist in the outwardly appearance of humans when we do language. Right. So that is how entrenched monolingual ideology is in the work that we do. And mm-hmm. I want to liberate us from that.
Yeah. So a couple of my clarifying questions personally for me when it comes to this is to make the distinction between translanguaging and translation. And you started by talking about code switching in there. Yeah. So for a world language teacher grappling with this idea of our students then just translating everything. So can you help us understand that a little better?
Sure. Translating could be a part of it, right? But it's a lot more than just that, right? Because they are actively using all the languages they know and everything they know about language. That's very important in order to do whatever it is that you're asking them to do in a language class. So you welcome them being able to say, oh, okay, maybe I know this word in English, or maybe I just know this general concept of what this particular linguistic feature can be, right? I'm talking in abstract, mm-hmm. but just to let you know that it's not about this kind of one-to-one equivalent that we're asking for. We're asking for you to bring all the tools you have in your linguistic repertoire to be able to do what it is that's required for you to do in a given moment in a language class. Mm-hmm. And most importantly, we're not tying anybody's hands behind their back and telling them mm-hmm. to, you know, for example, let me give something very common in Spanish and Portuguese programs, right? Usually Spanish and Portuguese programs are housed together, and usually somebody who's learning Portuguese probably already knows Spanish. And it is such a help to know Spanish when you're learning Portuguese that sometimes Spanish speakers are considered heritage speakers of Portuguese because the languages are so close, you know, et cetera. And many would even argue that these are not even different languages. They're just, you know, variations of what's generally from Iberia. So in our Portuguese class, a lot of work is done to try to quote unquote, separate Spanish and Portuguese. A lot of policing is done to kind of hunt out the Spanish and say, no, 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 forget about that. You're in Portuguese class right now. You have to be speaking Portuguese. And this notion that you have to speak in a way or write in a way that's pure, quote unquote, uncontaminated, quote unquote, you know, by other languages as if they were dirty somehow or, you know, and you have to essentially speak and write in Portuguese as if you have no knowledge of Spanish or as if you exclusively know Portuguese. And it's awful. And it's really stupid too, because anybody who knows Spanish, Spanish helps you so much in Portuguese, and you are actively relying on everything you know about Spanish and English and everything else you know in order to be able to learn and do Portuguese. So why police that? Why argue against that? And why actively demand that learners in your class kind of forget or ignore a wealth of knowledge they already have just because you want to maintain this artificial monolingual immersion environment in your class? And I say artificial because it's not only artificial in your class, it is artificial in those countries as well where they speak these languages, because you go there and you are exposed to all sorts of different, you know, plurilingual practices happening in those places. And then when you go, for example, to a Portuguese-speaking country, in Portuguese class in the United States, you're treated as if you're going to go to a Portuguese-speaking country and you're going to jump in there and all you're going to hear is Portuguese and that's it. And you better know Portuguese or else you're going to be flailing. And then you go to a Portuguese-speaking country and you hear Spanish, you hear English, you hear all these other things, and you actively rely on your knowledge in all these other languages to be able to do the Portuguese you're expected. So even those countries don't have monolingual immersion. Why are you trying to fight for it in your classroom and harm students in the meantime? And actively hamper their learning process because you're telling them that they can't use what it is they know to be able to learn what it is you're trying to teach them.
I'm thinking of the ideas of the intent versus impact, which happens a lot in the spaces of diversity and equity and inclusion, justice, belonging. But I think that when it comes to the immersion and the monolingual classroom, that the intent there from the teachers doesn't come from this place of harm, you know, when we look at immersion methodology and all that.
Of course.
But then in the end, there is a different impact, you know, and I think that teachers would get concerned with that. But I'm looking specifically at an example of, with the best of intentions, to separate. Like, we just do this language in this classroom. Say you're doing a Spanish, I'm doing immersion in my classroom. And you never have to teach students when they start to sound out a Spanish word to go from left to right, because they're English speakers. And so as languaging English speakers, they go left to right. Because if they're Arabic or Hebrew, they're not doing that, you know, or if they're coming from Chinese or Japanese, where there's no phonetic value, you know, to the characters. But without knowing how to read in English, but then we think, oh, well, you just know that. No, they just know that because they're using their linguistic knowledge of English and transferring it to their Spanish. So as much as you're doing this monolingual situation, you are banking on the fact that they know how to read in English so that they can read in Spanish.
Absolutely. You are relying on translanguaging, by the way. You are relying on them using their full and complete linguistic repertoire to be able to do what it is you want them to do. But then that's not what you're preaching, right? You're and I want to say that thank you so much for talking about, you know, intent versus impact, right? Mm-hmm. Because I do not in any way want to even insinuate mm-hmm. that we are out as teachers to harm students mm-hmm. or that that it is the intention. Quite the opposite. We are convinced in our classes that we're doing the absolute best for our mm-hmm. students, because the best way for you to be able to learn a language is to be able to speak that language. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we speak to learn. We don't learn mm-hmm. to speak. There is no, we sit down and just listen and absorb, you know, language learning through osmosis. And then one day we wake up and mm-hmm. we can do this language. We actively speak and write and engage in the language in order to learn this language. Mm-hmm. So I am not saying that you abandon entirely mm-hmm. the notion that you're going to hold very dearly speaking and producing the language, mm-hmm. the target language in the classroom. Not at all. Mm-hmm. What I'm asking for is to liberate and strategize, mm-hmm. right? The liberate part is very important, because in the way that we police the target language usage, like, or so hard, you know, right? Mm-hmm. In our language classes, and we make people feel bad, right? If mm-hmm. they in any way show that they speak other languages, right? Mm-hmm. So, because we're desperately trying to maintain this monolingual immersion. And we even also make teachers feel bad when they don't always function in the target language mm-hmm. Because they're somehow depriving students of this very valued, complete monolingual immersion. Mm-hmm. So I'm asking us to just liberate ourselves mm-hmm. and also liberate our learners mm-hmm. themselves, right? That's by understanding that it's okay, even in the classrooms where they hold monolingual immersion and target language speaking very dearly, they only achieve about 80% really mm-hmm. of exclusive target language anything. Right. So 20% is still working mm-hmm. in other languages, home languages and stuff, in order to facilitate what you do. Because, for example, try to explain a preposition without translating. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, try, you know, or try without relying somehow on the knowledge that mm-hmm. people have. Right. Of other languages to explain to them what N is in mm-hmm. Spanish. I mean, you'll spend all day long doing that if you try to do it exclusively in Spanish. Mm-hmm. And the simplest way to do that is to, you know, recall what it is that they know already and make explicit connections between mm-hmm. that. So we're doing that already, mm-hmm. but we're doing it with a lot of guilt. We're doing it with a lot of, you know, feeling as though, we failed somehow. Mm-hmm. We're not really adequately serving these students because mm-hmm. we can't achieve 100% monolingual immersion. Mm-hmm. So let's liberate ourselves mm-hmm. by saying that no, it is not necessary to do all that. It is very necessary to make sure that you're actively promoting the target language mm-hmm. and producing in it as much as possible, because mm-hmm. that's still necessary for learning. But free yourself, mm-hmm. right, from that imposition of you have to do it 100%. Yeah. And also understand how you can strategically translanguage, and you can strategically tap into translingual practices and translingual knowledges that your students have in order to be able to teach what is necessary and cover the ground that's necessary yeah. in your class. So that's my big advice is legalize and strategize.
Yes, yes. So one of my big liberating moments, to use your language there, was when I heard Florencia Henshaw, University of Illinois, where she said, focus on principles over labels. Like that, yes. That's the place to go. And when we label, you know, 90% plus 100%, the goal is target language. And you don't really understand the principles so much behind it as the label. And that's where the guilt comes in, that yes. I'm not doing this because that's what all the cool teachers are doing, you know, and that's the expectation, you know. But I think that going back to look at the principles, like what is going to actually help this rather than labeling it something that's this expectation. And so you started to mention some of the strategizing there. And I think that as world language teachers that are looking to embrace this idea, I mean, it clearly makes sense now listening to you. It's like, well, of course, yes. You know, I love the way that you are able to articulate it in a way that just makes it so obvious. So now you need to tell us how to do it. That's how it works, right? It's, you can explain it really well. So in terms of strategizing and leveraging this concept of translanguaging for world language teachers, what are some tips and strategies that you can offer to us?
Well, the good news is we don't have to reinvent any wheels, right? Somebody is already doing something. And I ask us to look at the example of what's happening in, you know, Europe, for example, when they're doing their work in Europe comes from this notion of plurilingualism and plurilingual practice. So here in the US, we work off of this notion of the monolingual. Like we are teaching a monolingual how to be another monolingual, basically, right? We are teaching a monolingual English speaker, the assumption is, how to speak like they were a monolingual in Spanish or Portuguese or Chinese or whatever it is that we're teaching them, right? So the first strategy is to let go of this notion of working in monolingualisms with monolingual people with monolingual goals. And let's work with the understanding that we are doing a plurilingual practice, that we are working with people who understand and are functioning in multiple other languages that, you know, we may not even be aware of what it is that they're doing, and mobilize those languages to support what it is that you're doing in your world language classroom. So the first tip is to do a survey of language practices in people's lives and in their homes, and to find out what exactly are people working with when they come into your classroom. And when you realize that, you know, they're working with certain languages, or they have understandings of other languages, or they come from heritage backgrounds of other languages, or this even varieties in English that you may not even be aware of that they're working with, but that's also plurilingual practice. So first strategy is to figure out who are the languagers in your classroom, what are they coming with? And the next strategy, the next step would be, how can you incorporate that into your instructional practice? How can you incorporate that actively into your teaching practice? What can you tell your languagers about what it is that they already know and how that can support their knowledge and their production in the language that you're teaching, in the target language? And actively use that, right? Create lessons that acknowledge that people are coming with different backgrounds and figure out how that can support their understanding and the skills that you're trying to impart in the particular lessons that you're working with. So I can't go into super specifics because, well, it all depends on what it is that you have in your classroom. But the biggest lesson is to actively work with the languages and the language understandings and language practices people come with, assume a plurilingual perspective and translingual practices in your classroom. Don't be scared when your languagers produce texts that we look at and we see that they're mixed in a certain way, for lack of a better way, and then start drawing X's all over their work and, you know, and telling them, no, this is incorrect. Try to figure out, well, how are they doing this? Acknowledge and welcome what it is that they're doing, and then show them other ways that they can do in order to approximate what particular skill or what type of text you want them to produce in the target language, or how you may want them to speak in this new language that they're learning.
Yes.
But also count upon your knowledge as well. You may share language backgrounds with these students, which will also help you to be able to tailor your exercises with them specifically to their needs and their understandings.
Right. So to bring this back to our initial conversation, you just said that you were talking about acknowledging and welcoming their linguistic experience. So can we bring that back to our critical race pedagogy?
Yes.
And how does having that expectation of monolingualism, even if it's the second language monolingualism, mm-hmm. how can we kind of remove that expectation, because it is actually harmful to acknowledging and welcoming the diverse linguistic experience of our students? So how can you,
well,
can you
bridge
those
that.
For us?
You literally you know, must
like, bridge I was trying to like form the question in a way that made sense, and I was like, I think I'm starting to answer the question, but I'd want to stop so that Uju could do it. So Uju, go, you do it.
But you literally answered the question. I want to model for you what I want teachers to do in their own classroom. Why am I going to tell you something you just said already?
I'm bridging the everything Absolutely. You were talking about with the beginning. So did I bridge it?
You did. You certainly did. You have explained it. You have explained that it's harmful, right? To be able to essentially erase people's identities in the classroom and discredit what they bring into the classroom by saying, well, it's not good enough, right? And it's not helpful here in what we do, and it actually might impede your success in this particular environment, which is not true. So, you know, that is not an inclusive environment, and that is not an environment that promotes belonging, because you are actively telling people that the way that they language is not right, and you're going to teach them how to language properly in order to be able to serve the purposes of your class, mm-hmm. which is at the very least harmful.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for providing all the details and insight that help us bridge that. And I'm happy that we started with that conversation so that we could come back to seeing how translanguaging includes
anti-racist work. Now, I also want to, you know, address this notion of error correction, right? Because the next mm-hmm. thing people are going to be like, well, do you mean to say that no one can ever make a mistake anymore? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, what do you consider a mistake in this language that they're learning if, well, anything goes at this mm-hmm. point?
And slippery slope,
you know, first of all, the next thing we know, we're not teaching German anymore. we're just teaching whatever it is people want to speak in the yeah. class. Okay, no, that's not what's happening, right? We can understand that the goal or a goal in a particular exercise is, okay, I want you to be able to produce a text that looks like this, or I want you to be able to reproduce this or that, right? What we're asking is the journey to get there involves you recognizing that people are going to work at it in a certain way and acknowledging that and figuring out what it is that you're going to expect that's not going to entirely discredit and not going to tell people not to use the tools that they have in order to arrive at a certain goal. We are talking about expanding people's linguistic repertoires as opposed to shutting it down. And that is a principle that you mm-hmm. should understand and work with in your classroom.
Brings it back to that, the principle over the label. So, Uju, you've shared so many wonderful things with us today. I was just wondering, are there any recommendations you would have for continuing to look into this work, maybe through you or others?
Yeah, I think that we live in this sort of siloed notion, right? Institutions. And even the fact that we're teaching language as a subject all on its own is a silo, as opposed to we're teaching, you know, math, for example, and the target language is a medium of instruction. So this notion is we're learning the target language and we're learning math at the same time. So even the fact our own academic discipline as a silo is problematic, and it's also being challenged right now because people are cutting off our language programs mm-hmm. because of how we've kind of stagnated, right, in our field, and we're not really making what we do seem relevant to other fields and what other people are doing. So a big advice that I would give all of us is learn and see what other people are doing in other areas of and other types of language classrooms. What are they doing in bilingual ed? What are they doing in dual language immersion? You know, what exactly is going on in all these other places? And this is where we learn skills that are necessary for us. And this is where we learn how to also expand our understandings of how to do what we do, right? So, for example, translanguaging is coming from bilingual education. Mm-hmm. What's happening in bilingual education, and how could that inform our world language classroom?
Yeah, the idea of the silo, I often hear from ESL teachers when I tell them, oh, this is what we're doing in the world language classrooms, and this is our new emerging stuff. And they're like, we've been doing that for 25 years.
Yeah. we are you know, behind.
You know, so it's like, oh, okay. But, you know, maybe if the ESL teachers were involved in our world language and it was considered a world language, then we'd all be learning from each other. But
I
often hear that from ESL teachers.
So why are we doing that? Why are all the linguistic classrooms or the language-based classrooms all separate from one another? Why do we publish at separate journals? Mm-hmm. Why do we, go to separate conferences? Mm-hmm. Why do, even in like our schools, why are we in separate departments? Mm-hmm. What's mm-hmm. going on? Why are we siloing world languages in ESL? And why are we even siloing languages themselves mm-hmm. and what we consider content?
Thank you so very much, Dr. Ujuanya, for being with us today and helping us to expand our repertoire of understanding. To quote you, use that term yes. many times. I'm like, that's going to be my big takeaway, is to just keep expanding what languaging means. I love yes. using the word language as a verb. I love that people are doing that now.
Yes.
So that way we are languaging and using it as another opportunity for our students to be respected and valued in our classrooms with the experiences that they're bringing. You made so many wonderfully useful and effective connections with translanguaging into other areas. So thank you so much for your time and wisdom with us today.
Well, thank you once again for inviting me to, to come talk to my people.
What are your takeaways from that conversation with Dr. Anya? I know that I am revisiting my beliefs around target language use in the classroom. Be sure to check out the show notes to connect with Dr. Ujuanya. You'll also see the link to sign up for Talking Points, my weekly email newsletter with tips and resources for language teaching. And there are also links to get in touch with me if you would like to work together. We can do that either in person in your school or remotely. I will talk to you soon. Bye for now. Thank you for listening to the World Language Classroom Podcast. Be sure to follow or subscribe wherever you're listening so that you never miss an episode. Let's keep the conversation going on social media. Connect with me on X, aka Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, at WL Classroom. And for even more valuable resources, visit my website, WLClassroom.com, where you'll find over 300 blog posts about language teaching. So stay inspired, keep growing, and continue making a difference in your language classroom.